Women's erasure from history. It's definitely a thing. Here is an example, and perhaps it may surprise you. Women's adoption of the zoot suit. Did you know in 1940s LA, an entire subculture, a political movement developed around this particular set of clothing items? Not only that, but pachucas, zooter girls, slick chicks, first to wear pants. That was quite a huge deal back in the day. But history largely recorded the zoot suit riots as a machismo-induced brawl amongst Mexican men. We should dig a little further than that. As has Catherine S. Ramirez. She's a professor of Latin America and Latino studies at the University of California. She is the author of The Woman in the Zoot Suit, Gender, Nationalism, and the Cultural Politics of Memory. Catherine, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Let us define our sartorial terms to begin, Catherine. The zoot suit. Can you describe that for us?
Certainly. There were many variations of the zoot look, and the look changed across time and space. So scholars usually distinguish the West Coast look from the East Coast look. And the East Coast look among men consisted of a long coat. It looked almost like a dress from the silhouette, billowing trousers that tapered at the ankle, a broad-brimmed hat, thick, heavy-soled shoes, what we called creepers when I was a teenager in the 80s. On the West Coast, the look among men was a little bit more streamlined, and men tended to wear a long, straight coat rather than the flowing, billowing coat that was more common on the East Coast. Men also on the West Coast wore the ballooning trousers that tapered at the ankle. And some men of Mexican descent on the West Coast wore the thick-soled shoes. Others wore huaraches, which is a traditional leather woven sandal that has been around in Mexico for centuries. It comes mostly from Central and Southern Mexico. And so they combine this very country, you know, this very rural shoe with a look that came to be associated with urban spaces, with cities like LA and New York. Women on the West Coast, Mexican-American women in particular, often wore the same coat that their male counterparts wore. It was called a fingertip coat because it was oversized. Women also wore skirts that were considered short at the time because they exposed their knees, and often these skirts were pleated. If they could get their hands on pantyhose, they wore them, fishnet stockings. Often they just pulled their socks up, you know, partway up their calves, almost to their knees. And some women wore huaraches. Some wore a kind of open-toe platform heel, tacones, high heels, as they're known in Spanish. The look did travel, though. It was popular across the U.S., among mostly working class youths of various races and ethnicities. But after the Sleepy Lagoon incident of 1942 and the Zoot Suit riots of 1943, the zoot look came to be associated with Mexican Americans in particular.
Zoot, what's the name about?
So that is a big question, but zoot is probably related to the word suit.
Uh-huh.
And zoot suit, you know, these words rhyme. And a big part of the zoot subculture in the 30s and 40s was not only the clothing, but jazz, you know, jitterbugging and lindy hopping. And you can see the East Coast version of the zoot suit as worn by Cab Calloway in the film Stormy Weather from 1943. You can also see that East Coast version in Spike Lee's biopic about Malcolm X. Malcolm X, when he was Detroit Red and Harlem Red, was a zoot suiter as well.
It's a sign of some sort of defiance, isn't it? It's a bit of a take on conventionality, but it's there's a sense of extremity, a sense of thumbing the nose.
In the context of World War II, yes, the Zoot suit became a sign of nonconformity, of extravagance. It was read as even anti-American. But among the people I talked to as part of my research, they saw it simply as a look, a style. And they admired it. They were like, that's just how you dressed if you wanted to be cool. And it was nothing more than that to the people I spoke to who were participants in this youth subculture of the World War II period.
Is that a thing which was different east to west coast? Was it perhaps more politically centered, if you like, on the east?
Not necessarily. I think what was happening in World War II is we see also this growing divide between young and old. So, you know, our notion of the teenager, this is very much a social, historical, and cultural product. And there was this sort of growing divide between the young and the old during World War II, especially among Mexican immigrants and their U.S.-born or U.S.-identified children. So the Mexican-Americans I interviewed for my research, many of them were born in the U.S., and many of them were born in rural places, you know, southern Arizona, New Mexico, but their families migrated to Los Angeles during World War II. This was a period of tremendous flux, of, you know, real social and cultural upheaval. We also see the second African-American Great Migration during the Second World War. You know, prior to World War II in this country, the population of the U.S. was actually very rural. Things changed during World War II. People moved to cities, they got new jobs, and they had disposable income. And so what was, I think, so threatening about the Zoot suit in both New York and L.A., for example, and on both coasts, was that you see young people of color, African-Americans and Mexican-Americans specifically, with disposable income and flaunting it in cities. You know, these were people who were supposed to be subservient, they were supposed to be rural, and they were supposed to be invisible.
Yes, it's a time of tremendous change, and that boldness to make visual statement of that change, there's tremendous assertiveness in that.
Yeah, and ironically, so many of the people to whom I spoke told me that Zoot suits weren't cheap. It cost, you know, around $75, $80 for the ensemble in the early 1940s. This was a considerable sum for a working class kid. And many of my interviewees had to work and save, and they owned only one suit. So the people I talked to, they said, you know, like, we had to work hard. Like, we weren't lazy, even though the suit was read as a sign of leisure and, you know, the non-productive use of time, in other words. Mm. And they considered themselves very patriotic. They, you know, many of my interviewees said, well, we were doing our part for the war. We worked in factories. We did this. We did that. And the suit was seen, though, as this real threat to the war effort and to the United States as a whole.
I want to get to pants in a moment because that's an important part of this story. Well, perhaps let's jump to that. I mean, the adoption of pants by women, that's adding another layer of confrontation to this style socially.
Absolutely. Yeah, so the women I spoke to, none of them told me that they wore pants. However, many of them expressed great admiration for the masculine version of the Zoot look. In particular, they focused on the crease in the pants, like just the amount of labor it took to iron out that, or to iron in rather, that crease, you know, to make it possible to define the leg with that crease. But there is evidence. We have a lot of visual evidence of women, Mexican-American women, who wore the complete tacuche, as it was known Chicano Spanish, the ensemble, and they wore the fingertip coat, they wore the Punjab pants, as they were known, you know, the billowing trousers that tapered at the ankle. And yes, this was a very transgressive look in the 1940s. This was a look that, you know, when women wore pants, it was something of a big deal, and women wore pants to work. And that work was all supposed to be for the war, you know, to support the so-called boys. It was not done to challenge gender norms or to seize authority, as we like to say when we say that one is wearing the pants.
You've mentioned both these incidents already, the Sleepy Lagoon incident in 1942, the Zoot Suit riots in 1943. Tell us a bit more about both of those.
Well, the Sleepy Lagoon incident was a tragedy. There were a couple of brawls that happened about 8 miles southeast of downtown LA, in a part of LA County that was more rural than it is today. And there was this quarry that had been appropriated as a swimming hole by the neighborhood youth, most of whom were Mexican American. And Mexican Americans began swimming at this place they called Sleepy Lagoon because they were denied access to segregated public pools. So a fight took place near Sleepy Lagoon in the early morning hours of August 2nd, 1942. And there'd been a party happening nearby. Some people tried to crash the party and a fight broke out. And after the dust settled, the body of a young Mexican immigrant by the name of Jose Diaz was discovered outside the host's house, and he never regained consciousness. He was beat up. He died at the hospital, and the law enforcement in LA used his death as a pretext for conducting dragnet raids throughout the east side of LA and holding Mexican-American youths as suspects in his murder. And some of these youths wore the Zoot look, and the press seized on this detail and declared the Zoot look the uniform of the Mexican-American juvenile delinquent. So there were 22 defendants in what came to be known as the Sleepy Lagoon case. They were tried en masse. 21 of them were of Mexican origin. One was white. He was also from the neighborhood. And eventually these 22 defendants became appellants, and they were exonerated and released from prison. But the young women who had accompanied them to Sleepy Lagoon and to this party, and it was actually a couple of young women who discovered Jose Diaz's body outside the host's house, they remained incarcerated for years after their male companions had been exonerated and released.
We move on to 1943 and the Zoot Suit riots.
The Zoot Suit riots erupted not even a year after the Sleepy Lagoon incident occurred. And so they took place in LA for almost 2 weeks, June 3rd to June 13th. Some people say June 16th of 1943. And these were a series of clashes between U.S. servicemen, so members of the military, and people of color, mostly Mexican-American Zooters. However, the servicemen attacked everyone. I mean, there was a report of an older Black man who had his eye gouged out, and he was just returning home from work. He was not a Zoot Zooter. So it was a very violent moment in LA history, and the riots came to an end only after the military brass had the servicemen leave LA. So, like, you know, shore leave was ended, for example, for Navy personnel. Yeah, it was a crazy moment.
Did the Zoot Suit ever go mainstream? Was it ever sort of appropriated by middle America?
That's such a great question. Not during the, yes and no, I'll just say. So the Zoot look did travel to the UK, and there are scholars who attribute the Teddy Boy look to African-American GIs They claim that African-American GIs exported the Zoot look during the Second World War to the UK, and that British youths took it up and, you know, they created the Teddy Boy look in the years following the Second World War. What we see in this country is, so the Zoot look morphed, you know, in the 1950s, it became much more streamlined. And we see a variation of it in Orson Welles' Touch of Evil. You know, the leather jacket, the James Dean look, actually, yep. Is very much indebted to that 1950s, and vice versa. These Mexican-American youths were also taking their cues from Hollywood. What we see later on, though, in the late part of the 20th century, early 21st century, we see sort of nods to the Zoot look in like Gwen Stefani's and Madonna's looks, for example. So yes, in some ways, you know, the Zoot look was appropriated by Hollywood, by celebrities, by, you know, directors like Orson Welles, at the same time that, you know, Zoot suitors were also looking to Hollywood for their inspiration.
Of course. An extraordinary circle, Catherine, of sartorial life. Thank you so much for walking us through that, a remarkable insight into, well, an extraordinary time of change and tumult.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Catherine S. Ramirez, Professor of Latin American and Latino Studies, University of California, and the book here, The Woman in the Zoot Suit, Gender, Nationalism, and the Cultural Politics of Memory. Blueprint, Radio National.